Eating Disorder has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza, robertaspizza.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Ah, yes, the pounding, pulsating beat of the opening theme song to Eating Disorder on heritageradio.org. I am your host, Crazy Legs Conti, and I'm with my co-host, Marcel Marceau. Marcel, say hello. And also co-hosting tonight is the Unknown Mime. It's a mime who wears a paper bag over his head. Say hello, Unknown Mime. Excellent. I'm glad. As you may have guessed, I am in the studio in the back of Roberta's Pizza alone, minus Liz the engineer, but she's not even in this room. Apparently, my co-host, Where's Paldo, a segment we've been doing to try to figure out where Chef Paul Girard is not even going to be a segment tonight because we also have Where's Revo, the Reverend, not here as well. So I am going to hold the ship down as best I can. And it could be like the Andrea Gale in that scene where Clooney sees a little daylight, but then, of course, the big wave devours him. The wave that has been devouring me, mostly towards the end of 2014 and then trickling off in 2015, has been consumerism. I am a consumer, and I seem to be influenced by the lesser arts, let's call them, movies and TV and some music. But I had started buying posters on eBay of an artist, Florian Bertmer. I couldn't get his Swamp Thing nor his Swamp Thing variant, and then I ended up with both of them. And then I started to delve into Gray Matter Art, which does some amazing posters, and on its way is a foil version of a Schwarzenegger poster. And then I started to buy clothing. I bought lots of shirts, Munsingwear shirts, the brand that has a little penguin logo and is perhaps worn by the dude. And then I bought pants. I don't even wear pants, but I was taken by some guy named Wang, scuba pants and other pants with pleated bottoms. And I just kept buying and buying camper shoes. And I rewatched The Interview on Netflix. And I thought, you know, that sweater that James Franco was wearing over the Flying Tigers, amazing. Looked it up. Of course, it was a Japanese Kenzo Flying Tiger sweater, $450 from the 2013 collection. But someone on eBay had made a print anything machine, and I could buy either a sweatshirt or a t-shirt with the Flying Tigers on it. So I bought the t-shirt, and then I thought, but Rogan is really the co-host. What does he wear in everyday life? And he goes to a Canadian company called Frank and Oak. And I ordered a shirt. I'm wearing it now. It's got a sort of a nature forest pattern to it. It's a little more stretched out by my love handle, so there's a little more forest there. Where is this going? Where could this possibly end? Of all the purchases I made, there's only one I feel good about. It's like eating too many Peter Pan donuts by the Nassau G station. That first coconut crispy is great. The sour cream glaze is great. But by the time you hit the third one in the cruller category, it's an empty feeling. But the one purchase I made has a little backstory. My friend Din Shaw, he kind of looks like Clooney in The American, tall, thin, handsome, hangs around with a lot of hot girls. And for his upcoming birthday, or for his former birthday, the girls said we all had to chip in like $50 or $100 to buy him a watch. I thought, this is unbelievable. A $750 watch. What is the watch, magical? Does it tell time with unicorns? I didn't even know. I pitched in the $50 and thought nothing of it. And then ads started to appear on bus stations about watches. This particular watch called Shinola, but perhaps it's called Chinois, as some stripper at Pumps told me, that's named after an Indian tribe. But there's a store in Tribeca, and the slogan is, there's still a little grit left in New York. It's from Detroit. And these watches are made in Detroit, and it's a company that's only existed for about 2 years. These are absolutely beautiful watches, works of art, and apparently they own a factory, and they make them in Detroit, and they're American-made, and they've got a $1,500 pocket watch in honor of Henry Ford. So I had done a gig that may be coming up soon on Nat Geo, a show called Brain Games, and I'd received some money, and I thought I should probably pay my rent, but instead, I invested in a watch from Detroit, and in the process of buying it, beautiful, black-faced, leather band, it made me interested in Detroit. It made me think, like, what's going on in a place that Dinshaw and I could go visit for the weekend, get a tour of the factory, the Shinola factory, and at the same time, instead of spending on a hotel room, just buy a house, like a timeshare, a 12-month timeshare, for as much as the watch costs. So it's about time to introduce our guest, who is not from Detroit, but is now in Detroit. And his name is Robert Elms. He's the creative director and founder of the Galapagos Art Space, which, for those of you who know New York, and really, if you know Ace Frehley's New York Groove, you know the Galapagos Art Space, 20 years in existence in two locations, Williamsburg and Dumbo, decided we're going to move to Detroit. So, Robert, from Detroit, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Welcome to Eating Disorder. We're very honored to have you on the show. And I guess some people's images of Detroit are kind of in between Escape from New York and Escape from L.A. It's like Snake Plissken might be abandoned there. But you have a much different view of the city that you now and your art space now calls home.
Well, we think, you know, it's a land of magical watches.
Exactly.
You know, it's a very, very interesting place, and you almost could. And in some cases, you actually could buy a house for the cost of a hotel room for a night. There are $100 houses here. And the beauty of Detroit, you know, thinking about my experience for so long in New York City, where I still live half-time, is, you know, imagine the $100 house and you know, 10 times your budget and then double it. And eventually you get to the house you want. So maybe you're at $10K. Mm-hmm. Maybe still that's not the house for you, but double it again and get to 20 or 40. And suddenly you've got a mortgage of, you know, $270 a month, and you've got a four-bedroom house with two bathrooms and a lawn and a studio, and you can rent a studio somewhere outside of your house if you want for a couple $100. I mean, basically you have sort of, you know, the endless reverse tail of New York City real estate. So, you know, you sort of have the opposite, the mirror here, where it's you know, seemingly endless in the amount of real estate that's here that you can repurpose, and that's really an exciting thing for young artists.
It is truly almost the bizarro world in terms of real estate, but not in terms of art. Obviously, your not so much exodus, I would call it your almost like the you know, caterpillar becoming the butterfly. Your flight to Detroit was covered extensively in a variety of publications, and, you know, New York Times, NPR, and somewhere, and I'm going to butcher it, somewhere you had this great quote about the things that a city needs, you know, regarding basically art, and they need artists and space to develop, and that in essence, New York was pricing the artists out, which is something we hear a lot, but maybe more than ever, where there's a bank on every corner, it could be true that this is the year of art leaving New York. Is that part of your reason for moving? The real estate economics of New York?
I mean, a good, you know, creative infrastructure and a cultural economy, which is, you know, the lifeblood of artists being able to sell work and dancers being able to get on a stage and get paid for it, you know, revolves around three factors, and that's time, space, and people, of which New York arguably has only people who don't have time or space. And in Detroit, you have time and space aplenty, and you're gaining the critical element of people to come here. Also, interacting with an existing artist community. There's been people coming to Detroit, you know, for the last, 15, 20 years in just the arts alone. And then there's people who were born in Detroit making art, of course. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, you know, grouping of people who are intentionally coming and people who have been here and people who are born here is meeting an opportunity in real estate that is incredible. And, you know, the idea that in New York City that you could not paint at night in your kitchen but actually have a studio is you know, just an impossibility for most artists in New York.
Yes, that would be in the mind-boggling character, you know, sort of notion in New York, whereas in Detroit it sounds like it's a reality. I've only been to Lansing, mostly at Mally's for a calamari eating contest, but it was on the day in which there was a lot of change in the automotive industry. And it's interesting to me that from the ashes of a very industrial, you know, steel and blue collar economy would rise this phoenix of the arts, which makes perfect sense. I mean, I think of, you know, the girl from Flashdance who was a, you know, stripper who was a welder, but then really she just wanted to dance. And I guess I'm going to dance because going back to when you first opened your art space in New York, dance was one of the things that I saw there the most. So you opened the Galapagos Art Space in 1995, I believe. Is that true?
That's correct, yeah.
And give me, where did the name come from? Was it an homage to the islands and Darwin, or was it just a cool name?
Well, it was the idea that, we would, you know, sort of accept empirical evidence versus faith over the idea of, you know, what we were going to create, or within the idea of what we're going to create. And the idea was also to evolve a performance space so we don't take grants or public money, and we've always operated on 100% earned income, which we're not only proud of, but it actually, we think, makes a much better space. The amount of time that a nonprofit traditionally spends managing its board and raising money is about a third of its time. We spend that time instead marketing. And so when the curtain opens, we think that there's often a bigger audience than there might have been otherwise. And so we think that that's sort of a service that we do provide for the artists that we present. So our job is to take people from the emerged, which is to say after the beginning, up to the mid-career point. That's our function. Mm-hmm. We do this over and over and over again. And so if we can build a bigger audience for an artist that we're presenting over time, then we think we're on our mission.
And all those different kinds of art kind of came together in the space, in that sometimes the walls would have photography or paintings, but really performance was maybe the mainstay, I guess. Picture, if you will, this beautiful, well-lit space, tables and chairs, not a hipster audience, a very eclectic audience sitting, drinking, eating, watching something that you really couldn't see anywhere else, meaning that there was what I would term kind of audience participation, performance art at Collective Unconscious and poetry readings and the New Yorker Cafe. But Galapagos had a feel, I think it's important you said, from emerging to mid-career, it had a feel that the people you were seeing, whether you knew their name or not, had in a sense already made it artistically or creatively, because what you saw was really something cool and spectacular.
But I think we were sourcing from our friends. You know, we made the space that we wanted to run. You know, so we didn't do only, and we never have done only one type of work. We're not a music venue. We're not an indie classical venue or strictly a dance venue. But encompassing all of those, all those different areas and sort of blurring the borders between them, and I think at our best, encouraging a lot of collaboration between disciplines. And I think that, you know, that's exactly what Waynesburg and, you know, and Dumbo in its early years really needed, was a space that kind of created a crossroads that all kinds of different folks could get their foot on a stage or their work on a wall. And, you know, I think when you begin to create that sort of, you know, mixing of all different sorts of things, you're dealing with a time, I think, that's very important to talk about. And that's just the experience of time, whether you have time or not to present work and to really understand the work of the artist that you're presenting, and whether as an artist you have time to make the work, to collaborate with friends and to understand what it is that you're really seeking as an artist and what your voice is and what your message is. And those things are inhibited without, you know, the opportunity of time. And I think what we're seeing in Detroit is a huge amount of time. And, you know, when I first went to New York City, I would work 1 or 2 days a week, and that would be enough to pay my rent and enough for, you know, beer money, and it was a lot of fun. And you need that time, especially when you're young. You need to be able to communicate with other people and understand what it is they're doing, and sort of challenge your own beliefs and challenge their beliefs and engage in that sort of post-university giant discussion that goes on for many years, and frankly, that's fun, you know? And the amount of fun that happens, you know, really can't be underestimated, because it is a glue in a certain sense. It's the experience that people are enjoying and the idea that they can look deeply into their motivations for creating work and communicate that with other people and do that in a sense that, you know, feels challenging and feels like they're really moving towards something important in their life. And, you know, that sort of career advancement, I think, you know, it really requires a mission presenter and a visionary artist to exist in the same conditions at the same time And that opportunity is decreasing in New York City, and it's increasing in cities like Detroit.
Excellent. So we're talking with Robert Elms about Detroit, about relocating the Galapagos Art Space from New York there. We're going to take a short break for heritageradio.org sponsors, and then we'll be back with Robert to talk about some of that art, both past and present, at the Galapagos Art Space.
Super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Wow, a little plug out there for Del Posto. I've had some of their cheese. It's really good. We are back with Eating Disorder. Our guest tonight, calling in from Detroit, is Robert Elms, the creative director and founder of the Galapagos Art Space. Robert, give me one of the early, late or mid-90s on North 6th Street in Williamsburg performances that made you feel like you were doing the right thing in starting a space. Was there something that struck your fancy?
I loved always very much our film series called Ocularis, which would pair a young independent filmmaker with, you know, some thing by Fellini or you know, et cetera. And these were wonderful, excellent nights where, you know, people got to sort of step forward and put their short film forward. You know, everybody from Nick Zedd to, you know, Donald Kelleher to, you know, others. And it was, that was a great night. And I've never seen before a programming win like what I'm about to describe. People would come and they'd put their $5 down, and they would say, "What are you showing?" And that, I think, really exemplified sort of, you know, a trust inside of a community and a trust inside of a programming model, which is Ocularis, which was, you know, the film series. We didn't run it; it was a co-presentation.
Okay.
You know, that was a great thing. Drums and Tuba, the National. You know, there were so many great artists that came through the venue. And it's really a privilege, you know, frankly, to work in the arts, but it's also a privilege to be there in the early stages of people's career. And, you know, we've stayed on mission to do that work specifically. You know, and it felt like over the years that opportunity diminished, and that as New York got more and more expensive and everybody's costs went up, you know, it became less possible for people to create. And we still see it in music. I think the music scene in New York City is fine. But in the studio arts, you know, and in places that need a different sort of rehearsal space, you know, perhaps
right,
a higher grade, maybe a sprung floor, you know, proper
sure, heating,
et cetera, you know, we're seeing that kind of environment is, you know, basically being burned through by an exploding real estate market.
I would agree. I mean, you know, I came to the Galapagos Art Space largely through dance, My former girlfriend was in the Evangeline Theater Group. Evangeline is out tonight. She was going to come in, but she has the flu. She sends regards. Her theater troupe does Buto, which is sort of a Japanese style of dance, very evocative, not a ton of movement, but almost in response to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, white-faced makeup, sometimes props. I know that when I saw my former girlfriend dance in this one piece with these strings, I had a very visceral response, and asking her, she always had an emotional response doing it. Evangeline would do avant-garde dance where some pieces would be her naked with a flower appearing from her butt, which sounds dirty, but it wasn't. It was just very beautiful and nice. And in both Galapagos spaces, one of which had a pool in the main area where you'd walk through, all of these things took on a different feel because you were transported somewhere else. But the space provided for the community in that, in Dumbo, my former roommate Jeremy George got married at the Galapagos in Dumbo. So the beauty of the, you know, leaving this amazing space and going out and seeing the bridge and the New York, you know, skyline, and feeling like you were very specific to a place outside the art space. But now I've seen pictures. Tell us where in Detroit the new space is located.
We're in, if you imagine Detroit, which is on the Detroit River, you know, by Lake Erie, right in the heart of the Midwest. If you imagine sort of Detroit as a donut, we're the donut hole.
Which is a good
city called
good
Highland,
place to be.
Highland Park, which is right in the center of Detroit, and we're in that area. We've been able to gather together a very defensible amount of cultural habitat, and we've, you know, been able to get 600,000 square feet for what amounts to the price of a small apartment in New York City. And, you know, you're talking about Evangeline and her work, and people like Sue N. Buto from Sweden. They were wonderful, wonderful artists to present. I mean, that was very fascinating and incredibly delicate work, which you can only do in an environment that, you know, doesn't require you to pay $50 a square foot for your real estate. I mean, it really comes down to sort of a basic equation in that sense. And in Detroit, we've been able to gather a lot of real estate, which then we think is going to improve over time, and we'll be able to therefore sort of pull the government together and the cultural uses that we want to bring to it, and eliminate what amounts to the predatory developer who would later come in and swoop in, you know, to take all those values and give them to a bunch of people who then wonder, where did all the art go that we moved into this neighborhood to consume?
Right.
And, you know, we think that by cobbling those sort of, you know, the government components, the civic component, and the cultural components together, that we can create an environment that's sustainable and that allows for a diversity of voices over time. So where we found in New York City that we weren't able to create a venue or keep creating a venue that had that amount of diversity in it, we're able to envision a project in Detroit where we can keep that in, you know, sort of a timeless sense. And we want to present that and document that model as what we would propose is to be a new cultural model. So arts aren't, you know, art is already in the real estate business. It's just not rewarded for it. And, you know, while we create all these values for all kinds of other people, it's the arts that, you know, traditionally go into an area and sort of, you know, help it to transform, and then are the first to be let go, quote unquote, in that second stage of development, you know, and the first one is often displacement.
Yeah, I think you almost want to run a reverse junket where you take those civic and government leaders from Detroit and send them on a trip to New York just to see everything that was in the arts that is no longer, because it's all been replaced by, you know, banks, basically, and real estate has taken over, whereas you have a real chance in Detroit to rebuild with legislation, the support of the government, to say these are the elements you want to preserve as your city grows and becomes prosperous and people move to it and flock to it.
I think that's a really, really good point. And if you look at things like cities like what Philadelphia, for example, is doing, they're working out a model, and it's in practice to some degree now, that sort of caps real estate taxes at a pre-gentrification level for certain incomes, right? So let's say that your area increases in value, there's an odd little twist of fate where you can lose your home because you can't afford to keep up with the real estate taxes that are reflecting the new values that are created. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, nobody comes along because your neighborhood gentrifies and gives you a raise at your job, you know, for that simple reason. So it's a way to keep stakeholders who have built neighborhoods in neighborhoods over the long term. And I think in Detroit, there's an opportunity to create you know, models that incorporate successes that we're beginning to see in other cities that are now dealing with the same questions. I mean, New York City is now, you know, going to create 1,500 live workspaces for artists, which is, you know, far too few and far too late. But it's a gesture.
And in all honesty, may not happen if de Blasio thinks he can build over the rail yards in any timely fashion. So it seems like Detroit has a real chance at saying we're building not only for today, we're building for tomorrow and for, you know, years after to make sure that the arts are embedded in the city's stonework.
Exactly. And that's why I think it's very important to bring the civic group, you know, the civic participants, the government, you know, people who are working on social justice and different areas of economic development, you know, social progress together at the same time, because there are huge resources the government can bring, and often that's simply through something like zoning. You don't really have to put money on the table, but you have to put opportunity on the table. And if you're creating, you know, sort of a sustainable pact and a requirement between the government and the cultural uses, and sort of creating a master framework and a master plan, if you will, then I think you can sort of bake those outcomes into the project. And, you know, while creating a place for private investment within that, which is, you know, what you're going to use to further the model, you know,
right,
to find the funding for it. So there always is, you know, there's a residential component mixed into what we plan here, and we think it's good to mix that in, because in New York City, if I'd moved there, you know, I arrived there in 1989, and if the city had been, you know, two stories taller all through Manhattan, I wouldn't have noticed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you'd taken that sort of value and found a way to turn that into cultural sustainability, then, you know, I would have noticed that, and, you know, perhaps Galapagos would still be in New York,
right,
City.
Well,
although we're desperately happy to be in Detroit.
Of course, of course, yeah. And speaking of culture, how many acts or performances or exhibits are you finding locally versus coming in from other places?
Well, we're investigating now everything that we can find here, and there's a lot. I mean, there's, you know, just in galleries, there's, you know, there's one called 333 Midland, which is worth a Google. There's 555 Gallery, which is in an old police station, which I believe was just sort of taken over by artists at one point because, mm-hmm, it was abandoned by the police. Corktown Studios, you know, is another exemplary project here. There's all kinds of people making all kinds of mission projects that you won't see in New York City, because in New York you'd have to hit the ground running, you know, within 3 months or your funding would be up.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was able to start Galapagos and fail for 3 years, you know, and build a little bit and have a rent party and move forward and finally open the venue, simply because of the entry, the threshold of entry was so low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I moved to New York a little after you in 93, and the company, the film company I worked for, the Shooting Gallery, did the same thing, which is they took over an abandoned crack house shooting gallery, and they would throw keg parties for rent money. So that,
yeah,
is no longer possible in New York. What performances and things are coming up that you're looking forward to in Detroit at the Galapagos Art Space?
Well, we're probably a year out,
okay,
from opening the venue, right? So, you know, we're doing a big, giant, we hope it's giant, barbecue,
okay,
in one of the new venues, one of the new spaces, excuse me, where the venue will be. And it's an entire block. You know, it's an old school with a cut limestone facade. It's just an amazing place with all kinds of outbuildings and alleys. And, you know, it's a place you just really sort of wander around and find things. And it's, you know, amazing. So we're very happy about that.
And where can people go to both donate and support the cause as you know, build out the space and get it ready for, you know, artists?
Well, if you're in Detroit, you know, if anyone's listening from Detroit, I'm speaking tomorrow at the DIA, Detroit Institute of Arts, on a panel, you know, talking about sort of our arrival here and what we plan on doing and the idea that we have for a Detroit Biennial, which we want to start in 2016. And anybody anywhere else, we're at GalapagosDetroit.com. That's our website, and we have a pretty, I think, robust explanation of what the heck we're doing out here.
That's great. That is great. Well, we are winding down here on eating disorder, but I can't tell you how much we appreciate you taking time out, which you've done, you know, in New York for over 20 years, and now clearly you're doing in Detroit. Robert Elms from the Galapagos Art Space, and really we've been fortunate in this weird podcast to have on a lot of esoteric or eccentric characters and people who are bartenders turned bar owners or had a creative vision for something and made it happen by, you know, selling their father's Chinese restaurant. But very rarely do we have somebody who could exist in the world of, you know, academia or intelligence personified, who has instead donated his time and efforts towards making the artists come to the forefront. So, Robert, anything else you wanted to add or mention before we say goodnight?
Come visit us in Detroit. You know, there's just there's really something happening here in the same way that New York was so valuable for, you know, 50 years after the Second War and advanced progressive ideas across the country, and California sent skateboards in return. I think that that's going to start emerging from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for people to see. And thank you very much for having us on.
Of course.
It's really a pleasure.
My buddy Dinshaw and I will be out. We will we'll tour a watch factory. We'll buy some watches, and then we'll check out the Galapagos Art Space with whatever is performing there in the donut hole, because that's the kind of place it is where we're happy to go any night of the week to see something amazing and unique. So thank you, Robert, and no thanks to my usual co-hosts who have disappeared, but managed to hold down the ship, so it seems to be doing all right. And
all right,
speaking
well, and you of, get all the pizza.
I get all the pizza, exactly. And tonight's pizza actually is sausage and some burnt kale, so very good. I'm going to put it in my pocket because I'm off to another New York institution, the Film Anthology Archives. I'm not sure how long they'll survive, but they have a Russian film by Alexei Goran. I saw Hard to Be a God, which never got distributed, and it was 3 hours of phlegm and poop and sci-fi. So I thought I'd check out some of his earlier work. So, Robert, New York does miss you, and I know you're here part of the time, but the arts are still trickling along here. But we really wish you the best in Detroit, and we think it's such a worthwhile endeavor. So thank you again for being on, and best to the new space.
Thank you.
And for all you listeners, we're at heritageradio.org, Eating Disorder every Monday night at 8. And hit us up at forkuradio.com and our Twitter handle and Instagram and a whole bunch of technological things that I do not get on my typewriter. And my carrier pigeon has gone missing. I'm Crazy Legs Conti. This is Eating Disorder. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.